He said that the legislature would certainly not segregate any money at all, ever, for the purchase of the Taylor estate. In the legislature and the courts, then, the issue appeared in February 1925, all but settled. To realize a dream of unprecedented scope, Robert Moses, by use of the law, had armed himself with unprecedented powers, and then, finding that these powers were still inadequate, he had deliberately gone beyond them, beyond the law. Entry and appropriation was, even as defined in law, of questionable constitutionality in its negation of the individual's rights when his property was coveted by the state. And Moses had gone beyond the definition to use the power of the state with even less restraint than the law allowed. But both courts and legislature understood the situation. Before both courts and legislature, Moses stood stripped of all defenses, and, it seemed in February 1925, both courts and legislature would now step in and rectify the situation. The courts by affording redress to the individuals injured by his actions, the legislature by ensuring that he never again had the opportunity similarly to injure any other individual. But the ultimate court in which the fate of Moses and his dream was to be resolved would be the court of public opinion. And in this court, Robert Moses had close to hand three formidable weapons. One was the fact that, like motherhood, Parks symbolized something good, and therefore anyone who fought for Parks fought under the shield of the presumption that he was fighting for the right, and anyone who opposed him for the wrong. The second was the fact that it was possible to paint the issue, as Moses had already done, not only as Park supporters versus Park deniers, but also as wealth versus lack of wealth, privilege versus impotence, influence versus helplessness, rich golfers versus the sweating masses of the cities. The third was the ultimate political weapon, Alfred Emanuel Smith. The Republican majority in the legislature drafted a bill, introduced by upstate Senator Warren T. Thaner, segregating $6 million of the bond issue for acquisition of various parks, but not appropriating any funds for acquisition of the Taylor estate. The bill also amended the laws Davison had introduced on Moses' behalf the year before. It eliminated appropriation as a method of obtaining parkland in developed areas, and also provided that all land acquisition for parks or parkways, including acquisition by condemnation, must be approved by the Republican-controlled state land board, that all park or parkway construction must be approved by the Republican-controlled state board of estimate and control, that all engineering work on parks and parkways must be carried out by the state engineer, an elected official who was then a Republican, and that all legal work connected with parks and parkways must be carried out by the office of the Republican State Attorney General, Albert Ottinger. During the last week in March, shortly before adjournment, the legislature passed the bill. Smith vetoed it. His veto, said Eberly Hutchinson, chairman of the Assembly Ways and Means Committee, was clearly the work of that expert and abusive propagandist, practiced in exciting the prejudices of the uninformed and a habitual defamer of the legislature, Robert Moses, who had boasted to him that if the legislature did not pass a bill he liked, the governor would veto it. But the veto did not help Moses or Smith. They needed $250,000. If it wasn't segregated, Moses' acts would be declared flatly illegal in court, and no governor would be able to put a good face on such a development, especially a governor who was, even peripherally, and only because he had been misled by an appointee, involved. Early in April, Smith told his advisors that he would summon the legislature back into special session to try to force it into the segregation. Moses' only hope of not having to appear in court without money or promise of money for the appropriation was to stall court proceedings until after the special session. Frantically, the commission's attorneys employed every legal stratagem available. They moved to strike certain clauses out of Patchogue's complaint. Van Sicklin denied the motion. They appealed his decision to the appellate division of the state Supreme Court. The appellate division denied the appeal. They appealed the denial to the Court of Appeals. Then they went back to Van Sicklin's court and moved to strike other clauses. Van Sicklin denied the motion. They appealed the decision. April dragged into May. The case, the judge commented, should have been tried long ago. But the commission attorneys filed new motions. Then they sought judgment on pleadings, a device which required the filing of a long series of successive briefs by both sides. Their briefs ran longer and longer. One was 275 pages. Then they appealed the decisions to the appellate division. Every appeal was denied, but everyone used up time. Macy raged at the delays. A speedy determination of the issue is what the public, the county, and the state are entitled to, he said. Although his rage did not require new fuel, Moses provided some anyway. Macy, the lover of antiquity, had determined to reserve one of the 30 home sites for himself and to restore the old Taylor Mansion, a fantastic mass of pillars, turrets, and cupolas, and its outbuildings to their original condition. But one Sunday in May, strolling around the property, he found the walls of the boathouse riddled with bullet holes. Targets tacked to the walls explained them. The state troopers had been using the buildings for pistol practice. As he stared aghast at the damage, he heard someone coming through the woods, and turning, saw another Sunday stroller, Robert Moses. Macy protested to Moses, pointing out that the courts had specifically forbade the commission to injure the property in any way. Moses replied with a grin. It's lucky it was this building. We're going to tear it down anyway. Once let him get Moses on the stand, Macy was sure, and the boasting would stop. He hungered for the court decision, which he was certain would vindicate him. But Moses kept stalling. So did Smith. All through April and May, Moses, anxious, was nudging the governor to call the special session. So, for less personal reasons, were Smith's other advisers. Since he had a great issue, they said, wouldn't it be best to press it while it was still fresh in the public's mind? Wait, Smith said. He had thought of something his advisers hadn't. New York City wasn't hot in April. It wasn't hot in May. New Yorkers weren't desperate to get out of the city in April and May, desperate for a bathing beach such as the one the Taylor Estate would provide. In April and May, they hadn't yet reached the point at which they didn't care at all about the legal technicalities of park acquisition. They hadn't yet reached the point at which all that mattered was that someone was trying to provide them with a place to swim, and someone else was standing in his way. On June 1st, a Monday, the first of the inevitable summer heat waves settled over the city like a hot, soggy blanket. By the weekend, the temperature was in the 90s. The city's people fled it. Traffic jams on Long Island were worse than ever. So great was the frustration that when motorists reached a town park in Huntington and found police barring the gates, they assaulted the police in such force that more than 40 were arrested. On June 10th, Smith announced the special summer session in a speech that was the first ever carried on a statewide radio hookup. There are people in this state who are opposed to parks, Al Smith said. His rasping, friendly, compelling voice sliced through the static of the crystal sets in tens of thousands of steaming living rooms in which sat families who had spent that last weekend in a desperate search for parks. There are people in this state who are opposed to parks, to the park program, because they do not desire public parks or parkways too close to their private estates, golf clubs, and fox hunting and polo fields. Smith spoke for 2.5 hours. Slowly, painstakingly, he detailed the whole background of his side of the fight, the attempts to remove parks from politics, the Republicans' insistence on injecting into park administration other politically dominated state agencies, on making the final decision on proposed land acquisition rest not with the State Council of Parks, but with the State Land Board. Let us compare both bodies, he said. Let us see who are the members of the Park Council. He listed their names, lingering over several. Everybody knows Judge Clearwater, he said. He is one of the leading lawyers of the country. He has been connected with the Niagara State Reservation since its establishment many years ago and has repeatedly been reappointed by governors of all shades of political opinion. Everyone knows Franklin D. Roosevelt, one of the heads of the Boy Scout movement in the country. Many of these men, he pointed out, were Republicans. All were serving the state without pay. Many have contributed large sums of money from their personal fortunes for the purchase of lands which they have presented to the state as a gift. What is the land board? He asked rhetorically. A purely political body. Its entire staff consists of one clerk and two land appraisers, all political appointees in office only since last January. They don't visit the lands, he said. They don't know where they are. Where, he growled, did the suggestion come from that this board be injected into the park program? From the wealthy people on Long Island who want the program to be controlled by an agency easily subject to influence and manipulation. The land board had never even been mentioned in connection with parks until the Long Island State Park Commission proposed taking a little of their land. Slowly and carefully, the governor spelled out his side of the Taylor Estate and Northern State Parkway fights, the need for parkland on Long Island, the great natural beauty of the spot selected, the attitude of the opponents, a few wealthy men, at the Biltmore hearing. As between the few and the many to be benefited, Al Smith said, I cast my lot with the many, and I signed the papers necessary to acquire the property by entry and appropriation. Immediately thereafter, high-priced legal talent was brought in to defeat the purposes of the state. It was from them and from their masters that the suggestion came to place the park program under the land board and to paralyze the program until this was done, because they knew that, before the land board, the golf club would probably win. So, Smith said, there is a greater question here than park councils, attorney generals, or land boards. There is a question of what will ultimately become of the $15 million authorized by the people. Will it buy choice park spots and locate parkways where there is fine air and scenic beauty? Or will money, power, and influence compel the state to buy for the people that which nobody else wants? The people are either going to get these parks and parkways through the properly organized commissions, or this program will be given into the hands of the very men who now desire to weaken it in the interests of the few. And Al Smith wound up his speech, as only Al Smith could. He was willing to leave the question to the people, he said. I am laying it before them in plain everyday language, and I am leaving it to them to serve notice on their servants and representatives in the legislature just exactly what their wishes are, he said. The cure for the evils of democracy is more democracy. Let us battle it out right in the shadow of the Capitol itself, and let us have a decision, and let us not permit the impression to go abroad that wealth and the power that wealth can command can palsy the arm of the state. In his speech, Smith avoided discussing the legalities or constitutionality of the appropriation, and he avoided, except for a single passing reference, any mention of Robert Moses. The Republicans tried to shift the focus back to the governor's controversial appointee and his actions. Replying on the radio the next evening, John Knight, Senate Majority Leader, said, The issue is one of law and order as against lawlessness and a violation of sacred constitutional property rights. With scarcely a dollar in sight or available for payment, Robert Moses, with the written approval of Governor Smith and with the aid of the state police, seized property of the admitted value of $250,000 and excluded the owners from such property. The question as to the legality of that action is one for the courts, and it appears that the owners of this property have brought an action against Mr. Moses for large damages. That is the big reason why Mr. Moses is so much concerned at this time and why he wants an extra session and funds to pay for this property. It is, Knight said, because a curb is needed on such wanton abuse of power that a check by an outside body, such as the land board, is needed. The legislature, he said, must safeguard private property against future unlawful seizure. Attorney General Ottinger issued a statement detailing the extravagance of Moses' $63,000 expenditures for cars and office furnishings. But sacred constitutional property rights and the price of office furnishings weren't the issue to the steaming millions of New York City or of the state's other cities. Twice more before the session, Smith took to the air to speak. Twice more he pounded on the theme of the few against the many, of wealth, privilege, and influence against the masses, of parks against the millionaires' golf clubs. The mailboxes of legislators were situated in 1925 in the Midway, the corridor between Senate and Assembly chambers on the third floor of the Capitol. Each morning, as reporters headed for the legislative chambers, they could see those mailboxes. After each of Smith's speeches, the mailboxes were overflowing with letters and postcards supporting the governor. And the press didn't help the Republicans. June 1925 was a hot news month. John Thomas Scopes was being tried in the sleepy town of Dayton, Tennessee, and among the 2 million words a day being telegraphed out of Dayton were enough to fill endless columns in the New York papers. More page one columns were devoted to speculation over the fate of Raoul Amundsen, whose expedition to the North Pole hadn't been heard from in 4 weeks, until on June 19th the Times could report Amundsen back safe. But in New York and other cities of New York State, no story was big enough to knock the park fight off page one. The Times, for example, carried during the 30 days of June 28 park fight stories, 7 in the lead spot, as well as a long summary in its Sunday magazine, reprints in full of the texts of the long speeches by Smith and Knight, and 8 editorials. The editorials of all the big city papers, with the exception of the New York Herald Tribune, notorious during the latter part of the 1920s for its espousal of the upper-class viewpoint, seemed to be vying with one another in whipping up public support for the governor's stand. The Times, in its only direct confrontation with the issue Macy considered important in the fight, said that perhaps Moses had broken the law, but that there were more important principles involved than that. It seems not unlikely that Chairman Moses has exceeded his legal authority, but he is acting in the interest of the people at large and of all future generations. The support for Smith and Moses spilled off the editorial pages into the supposedly impartial news columns. The paper in which this tendency was most striking was the Times, both because the paper strove so diligently for objectivity on other issues and because of its reputation. The Times was the Bible, emerging each morning with a view of life that thousands of readers accepted as reality, its biographer Gay Talese was to write. They accepted it on the simple theory that what appeared in the Times must be true. The slanting in the Times' initial story on the Taylor estate fight, the verbatim recitation of all Moses' points and the burying of Macy's, was not corrected in succeeding stories. Stories about court developments, which were unfavorable to Moses, were kept short and relegated to inside pages. Van Sicklin's flat statement that the appropriation was illegal and a violation of both law and the constitutions of the state and nation was on page 21, and it was exactly 5 paragraphs long. More favorable stories on political developments were front-paged and allowed to run interminably. It was not just a case of inequality in space and play. The Times's articles repeated, day after day, as if they were uncontested facts, the key contentions made by Moses and Smith. Story after story, for example, contained some version of the following paragraph. Wealthy members of the Timber Point Golf Club used social and political influence to try to get the commissioners to withdraw. That failing, they created the Potchog Land Corporation and bought the estate. The key contentions of Moses' opponents were almost totally ignored. Only the most diligent readers of the Times could understand, for example, that the fact that Moses had appropriated the property without money to pay for it was of importance. The fact was hardly ever mentioned, and the mentions it was given were fleeting. When Ottinger revealed Moses' $63,000 expenditures for overhead, the Times buried the story on an inside page and handled it this way. Albany. What is considered here as an attempt at retaliation by Republicans on Governor Smith for his veto of the Thayer State Park Bill is contained in a letter of censure sent by Attorney General Ottinger to Robert Moses. Moses' reply attacked the Attorney General for delays in searching title for proposed park acquisitions. It all but ignored the overhead. A Times editorial said, Chairman Moses' reply is a model of moderate statement. As the crucial special session neared, the Times began to resemble a Democratic House organ. Its article on the eve of the session said, The governor believes in parks. He loves them. The governor is well aware that he has a stiff battle ahead and is preparing to meet the situation with his usual vigor and undaunted courage. His motives for calling the special session, a contest that may add a new epic to the annals of the state, the article said, were clear. An abiding faith that the public can force this legislation in its own interest. Other possible motives, such as an upcoming, all but indefensible court action, were never mentioned. Part of the explanation for the Times' attitude was the friendship of Adolph S. Oakes, the self-made man from Knoxville who had become its owner and guiding spirit, with the self-made man from the Fourth Ward. During the 1920s, Smith regularly spent summer weekends at Oakes's summer home on Lake George. Part was the intense interest of Oakes, his only living child, Iphigene, Iphigene's husband, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, Sulzberger's niece-in-law, Mrs. Cyrus L. Sulzberger, of a whole clutch of Oakses and Sulzbergers, in fact, in parks. The old patriarch himself took a particular interest in preserving the Saratoga battlefield. In 1927, Moses, trying to buy up those portions not yet owned by the state, would find himself short of money, and Oakes would purchase two key parcels and hold them for the state until the money was available. In 1925, Mrs. Cyrus L. Sulzberger was active in the Park Association of New York City. Iphigene, a somber-eyed and idealistic young matron deeply concerned with social problems, had already begun to channel the idealism and a remarkable amount of enthusiasm and energy that was concealed but not muted by her serene manners and gentle voice into Park Association work. She had been, she would tell the author 40 years later, thrilled by Moses' state park work and anxious that the city should also get moving, and in 1925 she was active on a park association committee that was mapping a vast city land acquisition program and that listened raptly to Moses, who had agreed to help them work it out. The feeling of the publisher and his family showed up in the news columns of the Times, probably not as a result of any direct orders to editors or reporters, but as the result of their understandable sensitivity to their boss's feelings. Albert L. Warner, one of the paper's Albany reporters, recalls, Parks and conservation, they were dear to Mr. Oakes's heart, and consequently dear to the hearts of Times editors. So I was on the lookout for any attempt to interfere with parks. Not that I had specific instructions to do so, but the editors would react favorably to park and conservation stories, so the reporter naturally keeps his eyes alert for stories of this type. When, in 1931, Oakes received the annual award of the Park Association, the lettering on the illuminated scroll said, The New York Times, under his leadership, has made itself the mouthpiece of Friends of the Parks, using its great influence to educate the public to an understanding of the place of the parks in modern life. Whatever the reason, the daily press coverage of the park fight made Smith and Moses look very good, and the Republican legislators look very bad. The Republican legislators realized this. Faced with an election campaign in November, many of those from New York and downstate districts began to panic. But Hillies and GOP National Committeeman George K. Morris, representatives of the powers that ran the party, traveled to Albany and held them in line with naked threats and blandishments. And the upstate legislators didn't have to be concerned about November. One man, one vote upstate agitation was decades in the future. These legislators represented New York State's rotten boroughs, districts whose voters numbered in the thousands, not the hundreds of thousands, and who were farmers who had no interest in parks and who were, moreover, fanatically opposed to government spending. The idea of spending millions for parks had appalled them in the first place. The bond referendum might have rolled up a statewide majority of more than a million, but, with a single exception, Ulster, where old park philanthropist Judge Alphonse Trumpbore Clearwater took the stump for it, every upstate county had voted against it. Upstate New York in 1925 was a stronghold of prohibitionism, of Protestantism, of prejudice, of Ku Klux Klanism, and of republicanism. Opposing Smith's park policies could only help upstate Republican legislators, not hurt them. As the legislators arrived in Albany for the special session, bitter against being called to the Capitol in the summer heat, reporters asked them if there was any chance of a change in their position. "We'll melt in our seats first," one said. When a reporter asked Knight if he might change his mind, Knight replied, "I don't change my mind very often, do I?" Nonetheless, Smith smote them hip and thigh. The Republicans held a majority of 7 in the Senate and 42 in the Assembly. He had to switch 4 votes in the Senate and 22 votes in the Assembly to win. He sent Moses and other emissaries to the Republican members of the State Council of Parks, the old men who had been fighting for parks for decades, and asked them to intercede with the legislators from their districts. The park philanthropists were men who ordinarily had influence in Republican councils. No legislator from a district anywhere near the headwaters of the Hudson dared publicly to oppose Judge Clearwater's wishes. At a Republican caucus, the park philanthropists spoke one after the other. Not a single legislator dared openly to argue against them, but they had their orders. A reporter wrote that, when the speeches were finished, the Republican leaders sat speechless until they finally filed their terse refusal to reconsider and quit the conference. Persuasion having failed, the governor tried other methods. Westchester, he saw, was a weak spot in the Republican wall. Boss William Ward wanted a new charter for the county, one that would centralize its government under his thumb, and the necessary county referendum on the charter could be authorized only by legislature and governor. A bill authorizing the referendum happened even then to be awaiting Smith's signature or veto. Moses paid a visit to Ward and one of Ward's senators, Seabury C. Mastic. Smith signed the bill, and soon political observers were reporting that Ward had promised Smith the votes of the 7 legislators he controlled, and that Mastic might even introduce the park bill Smith wanted. The Citizens Union and City Club reformers had great influence with Republican legislators from New York City. Smith sent Moses to see them. The younger reformers admired Moses. Many of the older men were disenchanted with him, but they believed in the cause for which he was fighting, and they rallied to it. Park development should be determined by sound principles. These sound principles, the Citizens Union believes, were outlined by the State Council of Parks. With reformers who still had doubts, Smith lent a hand. When, in a chat in the City Club lounge, lawyer Joseph M. Price told Moses that perhaps a central supervisory body, such as the Land Board, wasn't a bad idea, Moses excused himself, went to a telephone, and called Smith in Albany. And hardly had the chat ended when Price received a telegram from the governor explaining why the Land Board idea was bad. Reformer William P. Ralstone boarded a train to Buffalo, in a single day persuaded the Buffalo Council of Catholic Women, the Buffalo Civic Club, and the Buffalo Central Labor Council to pass resolutions supporting Smith's stand, and then headed for Syracuse and a dozen other upstate cities and towns. The upstate park philanthropists were out working, too. Old Judge Clearwater himself driving night after night to little villages to talk on their local radio stations. Franklin D. Roosevelt of Hyde Park assailing the invisible hand behind the Republican policy. Then Smith and Mrs. Moskowitz conceived a masterstroke. They told Moses to call a meeting of the 73 Regional Park Commissioners and to hold it in the Executive Chamber at 2 p.m. June 22nd, just 6 hours before the opening of the special session, a move that ensured that the influential commissioners would be on hand during the session, available to bring further pressure on wavering legislators and to dramatize to press and public the contrast between the attitude of the legislature and of men genuinely interested in parks. GOP leaders pleaded with the commissioners not to attend, telling them that they were working against their own party, but the old men were loyal to their parks. They canceled vacation and business trips, and all but 19 of the 73 were present, packed into the visitors' gallery of the Assembly Chamber along with the largest crowd the chamber had ever held, as Smith, speaking not from the raised speaker's chair but in the well of the chamber, a spot where he had stood so many times before, stood so close to the senators seated on folding chairs brought in specially for the occasion that he could touch them. And he told them, "You created the State Parks Council. I kept politics out of it by appointing to it these men, mostly Republicans. They include some of the greatest men in the state, and it's their plan, not mine, that you're killing." Smith's speech brought the packed galleries to their feet, cheering. Smith had asked the legislature for permission to have his speech broadcast. It had not dared refuse. 4 microphones had been set up in the Assembly Chamber well, and as the cheers thundered down on the legislators, they could look at the microphones and know that they were being echoed throughout the state. But when the Republican legislators emerged from behind the closed and guarded doors of their caucus, not a single one, not one from New York City, not even one from Westchester County, was still supporting Smith. Not only would the GOP not segregate the funds Smith had asked for, but by a straight party-line vote, the legislature repassed the identical bill that Smith had vetoed. With the legislature confronted by an outpouring of public pressure as great as any in the state's history, the barons of Long Island had laid down the law to the lawmakers, and their orders had been obeyed. The roll call in the Senate was completed at 5 p.m., in the Assembly at 6:30. At exactly 7 p.m., the governor again vetoed the bill, in a sequence that a Times reporter wrote, "is likely to set a mark in legislative history for the record-breaking speed with which it went the route from legislative approval to executive condemnation." Bitterness roiled over Albany. In a voice shaking with emotion, John Knight, usually so stolid, stood at his Senate desk and cried, "He, Smith, ought to sign this bill instead of dancing up and down like a spoiled child. People on Long Island are afraid to go to bed for fear that when they wake up in the morning they would find their property seized by Robert Moses," another Republican senator shouted. Jumping out of his seat, a Democrat replied, "Is it not true that if they don't go to bed on Long Island it is because the bed sheets may be in use elsewhere?" A reference to the Ku Klux Klan. And Jimmy Walker, his suavity gone for a moment, his cravat for once askew, shook his fist at the Republican senators and shouted, "These millionaires made their millions out of the poor despised kikes and wops of the tenements, whom, through you, they are now seeking to shut out from a day in the country." From the governor's chambers, Smith thundered that sealed orders had been delivered to the GOP. The Westchester delegation had welched, he said. Seabury Mastic had promised him support. He did not say what he had promised Mastic in exchange, but Mastic later had confessed to him that there had been brought to bear on him too much pressure for him to resist. Others quoted Mastic as saying that he had been told bluntly that if he supported Smith, "my career would end." The facts which confronted Smith and Moses after the special session were as bitter as the shouting. Not a cent had been appropriated for park acquisition or development. The option on the 2 miles of beachfront at Hampton Bays was lost, and the land was promptly bought by 3 developers, who divided it into lots and began to erect bungalows on them. The option on Sunken Meadow was lost, and while the land was not sold, its value had obviously been tripled or quadrupled by the publicity. Other property on Long Island that Moses had coveted was being swallowed up by real estate developments. More important, politically at least, there was still no money to lacquer even a veneer of legality over the ugly surface of the Taylor estate appropriation. An angry Justice Van Sicklin had scheduled the Taylor estate trial for September 1st and had said that no further delays would be tolerated. On that date, Macy was at last going to get Moses on the witness stand, and Moses was going to have to admit that he still didn't have money available to pay Macy for the property he had taken from him. Smith and Moses might have reaped a windfall in the political arenas of Albany, but they knew that advantage would be lost when the act they were defending was flatly declared illegal.
"Well," Smith said to Moses one afternoon when the two men and Mrs. Moskowitz were alone in the Biltmore apartment, "can't you get someone to give you the money to make the thing stick?"
"Who?" Moses said. The kind of money they were talking about was too much for his own family even to consider. Real wealth was required, and people with real wealth were the people who were angriest at him. No, he said, he didn't know anybody. And they couldn't take a chance on a turndown. If they asked someone who refused and then spread the story that they were desperate for funds to legalize the seizure, the Republicans would make capital of it, and so would Macy's lawyers. They could make only one phone call, and they couldn't make a mistake in deciding whom it would go to. The two men turned to Mrs. Moskowitz, who had been sitting quietly in the corner, her head bent over her knitting. "August Heckscher," she said. Smith was doubtful. He knew that Heckscher, a 76-year-old multimillionaire philanthropist, was a recreation enthusiast who had already donated a playground to New York City. But a playground cost a few $1,000s. What was required here was $250,000. And Heckscher was an elf of a man, so short that when he sat on a chair, his shoes dangled several inches above the floor. With a snow-white goatee, a snow-white fringe of hair around his bald pate, spectacles, and a perpetual serene little smile. He would know that he would probably become involved in the lawsuit if he gave the money, and he hardly seemed the type of man who would voluntarily enter so savage a fight. But Mrs. Moskowitz, who had worked with Heckscher on various charities, thought he would, and she telephoned him. He agreed immediately. If it was true, as Moses' opponents were to charge, that the little millionaire demanded in return that the park be named after him, Moses must have considered this a cheap price to pay for the opportunity to be able to say in court that he had money to pay for what he had taken. Even with Heckscher's contribution, the court fight did not go well. Commenting that it would be a pretty state of affairs if a state commission could go about seizing land with gifts provided by private individuals, Macy's attorney, Charles H. Tuttle, later a Republican candidate for governor, said that if Moses used the money to reappropriate the land, he would be confessing that the first appropriation had been illegal, and Macy and his partners would be entitled to damages for that first appropriation. And the second appropriation would be as illegal as the first, because, he said, state law required that the money for a land appropriation come from legislative segregation, not from some other source. Moses apparently feared Tuttle was right. Smith tried privately to persuade Macy to accept Heckscher's $250,000, plus another $12,000 the millionaire had donated to take care of accrued interest, for the first appropriation and drop the fight. Even when Macy indignantly refused, Moses apparently tried to avoid reappropriation. When the formal examination before trial began, the step had not yet been taken. At times, Moses seemed almost desperate to avoid being put under oath. On the day he was scheduled to be examined, he didn't show up in court. Tuttle asked Justice Selah B. Strong to cite him for contempt, but Strong accepted a commission attorney's explanation that Moses had believed that arrangements had been made for him to be examined at his office. And when Moses, ordered to appear, finally took the stand, he did not make an impressive witness. Testifying under oath,
He swore that he had never been advised by anyone that the Taylor estate appropriation would be illegal unless the legislature segregated money for it. Had he not been advised precisely that several times, Tuttle demanded, orally and in a written memorandum, by Deputy State Attorney General Irving I. Goldsmith? No, Moses said. Tuttle thereupon produced the Goldsmith memorandum and waved it in front of Moses as he sat on the witness chair. Before the start of the actual trial, Moses, apparently forced into the act, took the step of reappropriation, and his attorneys began a new series of delaying actions in an attempt to stall the proceedings until January, when there would convene in Albany a new legislature that just conceivably might give him the appropriation he needed. Assailing the commission's dilatory tactics, Norman S. Dyke, the latest in the relay of judges sitting on the case, said the trial would begin October 18th without fail. On October 18th, he called the case, and Moses was not present. I especially asked Mr. Moses to be here at the opening of this trial, and he might have had the courtesy to grant the court's request, Dyke said from the bench. It seems as if his absence, unaccounted for, shows a studied effort to affront the court. Tuttle asked that he be punished for contempt, but Dyke accepted a commission attorney's explanation that he had advised Moses it would not be necessary for him to appear. The attorney then moved for a jury trial, and when Dyke granted the motion, the start of the trial was delayed until December 6th. On December 7th, the commission attorneys filed more than 600 pages of briefs asking for dismissal of the case, but Dyke peremptorily denied the motion, and there was a note in his decision that the commission could only have considered ominous. As the Times reported, in his decision yesterday, the judge ruled that the commission had not had appropriated at the time the Taylor estate was seized the funds necessary. There were ominous developments on another front, too. Jones Beach was owned by the townships of Hempstead, Oyster Bay, and Babylon, and while the Long Island State Park Commission could buy, condemn, or appropriate land owned by private individuals, state law provided that property owned by a township could be transferred to other ownership only by a vote of the township's residents. Moses had decided to try Babylon, where he spent his summers, first. On July 18, 1924, he had appeared in the red brick Babylon Town Hall and asked the town board to hold a referendum. The five board members just stared at him. They had been elected, placed in their seats at the board table by the votes of the baymen, and they knew that one way to make sure they would not be re-elected would be to demonstrate anything less than complete vigilance over the priceless heritage of the sacred Bay Bottoms. The Babylon leader reminded them that Babylon wants this land, which has been hers for nearly a century and a half before the state came into existence, to keep as a heritage for its children. Keep it. It is a park at present, a natural park swept by breezes from the bay and ocean. Enjoy it as it is or improve it, but keep it. Never surrender one inch. Let the commission spend its money elsewhere, its editorials advised Moses, before it attempts to snatch property that the residents of the town of Babylon intend to keep for their children's children until the end of time. Within 2 months after Moses' request for a referendum, not only the Babylon Town Board, but the governing board of every village on the south shore of Suffolk County, as well as the village's chambers of commerce, boards of trade, and civic associations, were lined up against the proposal, and Judge James B. Cooper, editor and owner of the Leader, could proclaim with satisfaction that the project at present has as much chance of carrying as a great South Bay clam has of growing teeth. When Moses turned to Oyster Bay, furious Oyster Bay citizens formed a Save Our Beaches committee that within days had a membership of thousands. In desperation, Moses turned to Hempstead, although he knew that votes in Hempstead Town, as indeed in all of Nassau County, went whichever way the county's iron-fisted Republican boss, G. Wilbur Doughty, wanted, and he had been unable to convince Doughty to want Jones Beach development. Doughty allowed the proposition to be placed on the ballot in the November 1925 election, and the vote was 12,106 to 4,200 against it. 40 years later, Robert Moses would remember how he had felt in 1925 when he heard the Hempstead referendum results. "It looked like we'd lost Jones Beach," he would recall. "It looked absolutely hopeless." More than with any other single project, his dreams had been tied up with Jones Beach. And so had his sense of urgency. He had been hearing with increasing frequency rumors that real estate developers were making deals with Doughty's Machine to have the town turn over the land to them for private development. In his mind's eye, he could see those vast stretches of untouched sand covered with shabby bungalows. He knew there would never be another opportunity to create a great beach so close to New York City. "You know," he would recall, "if we lost Deer Range, it would have been bad, but it wouldn't have been the end of the world. But if we had lost Jones Beach..." His voice would trail off, and then, remembering, he would say, "And I thought we had lost it." At the end of 1925, Robert Moses might well have thought he had lost his entire Long Island dream. The fact that development of Jones Beach could not be begun without approving votes from 3 townships, and that the 1 township that had voted had disapproved by a 3-to-1 margin, was only part of the story. Not only the options for beautiful Sunken Meadow and for the beach at Hampton Bays, but for those of the Southern State Parkway right-of-way for which he had drunk beer with farmers had lapsed for lack of money to honor them. His negotiations with the North Shore Barons for right-of-way for the Northern State Parkway had dragged to a complete halt. He had secured easements from New York City for its watershed properties, but he had no money to develop those properties as parks, and there was no money in sight to enable him to do so. There was no money in sight to develop any park on Long Island. The legislature had refused to appropriate any in 1925, and there was no reason to believe that the Long Island barons would be any less secure in their control of the legislature in 1926. Al Smith's loyalty and August Heckscher's money had pulled him back from the edge of the precipice along which he had been tightrope walking in the Taylor Estate affair, but he was shortly, all too shortly, to stand trial in the affair, and the outcome of the trial might well result in the loss to the state of that property, too. And even if Heckscher's gift let the state keep the Taylor Estate, there was no money in sight to legitimize the appropriations at Montauk Point and Lloyd Neck. The only concrete result of all the talk about parkways on Long Island had been an increase in the rate at which real estate promoters were littering the island with their rows of houses. Every week that winter brought the announcement of another large tract of farmland bought by a developer who was planning to erect model homes on it in the spring. It had been more than a year since Robert Moses had announced his revised and broadened park and parkway plan, a plan which had, after all, included parks and parkways not only on Long Island but throughout the rest of New York State, along the Niagara frontier, in the Genesee Valley, in the farmland of the Taconic region, and among the peaks of the Alleghenies, Catskills, and Adirondacks. Now, more than a year later, parks and parkways were still located nowhere but in the map of Moses' imagination. After all the talking, all the planning, all the fighting, they simply didn't exist. And at the end of 1925, there seemed little possibility that they would come into existence at any time in the foreseeable future. If one looked ahead a decade, even a generation, it seemed unlikely that any substantial part of the dream would be reality. Within 3 years, almost all of it would be reality. Chapter 12. Robert Moses and the Creature of the Machine. There were many complex reasons for the realization of Robert Moses' state park and parkway plan, but the key reason was simple: the further evolution of Robert Moses. The construction of parkways, like the construction of conventional highways, was a potential source of great wealth to politicians. Parkways meant construction contracts. Politicians who had a say in which firms received those contracts could expect financial remembrances from a successful firm, if indeed they, or a relative or a trusted associate known in political terminology as a bagman, did not actually own a piece of it. Parkways meant real estate transactions, generally either purchase or condemnation, both methods under which landowners could expect to do well financially. State public works officials, anxious to begin construction and not too concerned about price because the money they were offering was not their own, were traditionally more generous than private buyers. If politicians were the landowners, if they bought the land at pre-parkway prices from owners who didn't know the parkway was coming and then sold it to the state at right-of-way prices, they could expect a large profit. It took longer to get one's money through condemnation, but the rewards could be even greater. The success of politically well-connected attorneys in winning high condemnation awards from Court of Claims judges who also had risen through the ranks of political machines was an open secret in legal circles in New York State during the 1920s, as it would be in the 1960s. And parkways meant development. Sleepy countrysides, long static because of their inaccessibility, suddenly became desirable locations for factories and housing developments when a parkway brought them close to a city or large town. Land in these areas became suddenly valuable. Land near the parkway's exits, automatic focal points for development, became particularly valuable. The politician who bought this land at pre-parkway prices and sold it as or after the parkway was being built could reap great profit. And the politician who bought the land but instead of selling it developed it himself, building himself the houses and factories, could reap a fortune. Moreover, in terms of development, the impact of a parkway spread in ever-widening ripples. Stores and laundries and gas stations and insurance brokerage firms for the residents of the houses, subcontractors and material supply houses for the factories. This meant a burgeoning in land sales, insurance premiums, legal fees, in all the areas in which politicians grow fat. It meant as well an intangible but intense additional attraction for politicians. In a dormant area, opportunities were limited because everything was cut and dried, prices for land, for instance, being well known and firmly established. In an area opened by a road, everything was changing almost on a day-to-day basis. Opportunities were wide open. To take advantage of the financial opportunities provided by a parkway, a politician had to have foreknowledge. If he wanted to be first online with his recommendations for construction contract awards, he had to know that the highway was going to be built. If he wanted to buy the land that was to be acquired for the highway's right-of-way, or land strategically near the highway, he had to know where the highway was going to be built, not its general location, but its precise route, so that he could buy the exact lots that would be acquired, and he had to know before the owners knew, so that, not knowing that their land might be valuable, they would sell cheap. And politicians had a weapon they could use in obtaining such advance information. If they did not get it, they would not approve the building of the highway. The young Robert Moses, the idealist of Yale and Oxford and the Municipal Civil Service Commission, would not have even considered trading contracts or information for approval. Even the older Robert Moses of the New York State Association, a Moses more admiring of the ways of politicians, would not have done it. That Moses could, in 1922, still reserve his bitterest state bulletin sallies for the Nassau County Republican machine because of its link with political contractors. Even the Moses of 1924, doffing his principles to lighten himself for the pursuit of his greatest dream, wouldn't do it. No sooner had he announced his park plan in 1924 than intimates of the governor wrote him asking for advance information on parkway location. Moses indignantly refused to give it to them. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Charles J. Hewitt offered to sell the State Parks Council a tract of land he owned in Fairhaven. Despite Hewitt's importance to his dream, Moses refused to buy. Moses apparently took the same attitude in his 1925 attempt to persuade Hempstead Township to cede him its portion of Jones Beach. Hempstead was controlled by Nassau County GOP leader G. Wilbur Doughty. Today, they talk about political bosses. Leonard W. Hall, former national chairman of the Republican Party, would say in the 1960s, "They don't know what a real boss was. Doughty was a real boss. When he spoke, the discussion was over. He always kept his word. He was known for that. But cross him, and you were finished. There's no one like him today. We used to call him the last of the Mohegans." A square-faced man with a walrus mustache, Doughty had an almost visionary concept that rural Long Island would one day be a heavily populated suburban area and was always interested in suggestions for public works that could help open the island to development. But his vision was heavily mortgaged to practicality. He ran one of the most corrupt political machines in the state. In Nassau County, one observer said, zoning was bought and sold like potatoes. And much of the corruption revolved around public works. Doughty's brother-in-law, Uncle Andy Weston, was president of Booth & Weston, the largest contracting firm in the county, and Booth & Weston, along with Hendrickson Brothers, Inc., another firm with which Doughty had close ties, were habitually given the lion's share of county contracts. And since many GOP county committeemen happened to be on the payroll of the two construction firms, the firms helped Doughty keep them in line. The link between Nassau politicians and contractors had come close to surfacing in 1922. In that year, a Supreme Court justice had impaneled a grand jury to investigate it, and the investigation had already turned up a loan from Booth & Weston to Assemblyman Thomas A. McWinney, before McWinney persuaded the legislature to pass a bill establishing a commission to investigate the judge, a move that effectively stymied the grand jury. Moses had followed the case closely in his state bulletin. Calling the bill legislative brigandry, he had nominated it for his Worst Bill of the Session Award and had castigated the Nassau GOP machine and McWinney, whom he termed the creature of the machine. Moses must have known what it took to get things done in Nassau County, but he apparently wasn't willing to do them. The best proof of that was, perhaps, the defeat of his Jones Beach referendum. But in late 1925, the dream all but dead, Moses held a series of private meetings with Doughty. There is, of course, no record of what transpired at these meetings, and no proof that any deal was entered into. But certain developments ensued. Moses announced that future planning for Jones Beach would be conducted in conjunction with a delegation from Hempstead Township, which would, of course, have access to commission plans showing the precise location of the proposed Meadowbrook Causeway to Jones Beach, and the chairman of the Hempstead delegation turned out to be Assemblyman Thomas A. McWinney. And Moses was soon meeting regularly with the creature of the machine on an extremely friendly basis. Within 2 months after Moses and McWinney began meeting, a lawyer who was a member of the Nassau GOP's inner circle formed a corporation with a group of associates. The only business the corporation ever transacted was the purchase and sale of land, and the only land it ever purchased and sold was 265 acres of undeveloped, all but worthless meadow and swamp land, 99.5 acres of which would become the right-of-way for the Meadowbrook Causeway, the remaining 165.5 acres of which would, when the causeway had been completed and the land's value enhanced, be sold by the corporation to private developers. When the contracts for the causeway and for other park commission projects on Long Island were awarded, a substantial number went to Uncle Andy Weston and Hendrickson Brothers, Inc. And the last of the Mohegans abruptly left the teepee of the commission's opponents and smoked the peace pipe with Robert Moses, supporting every one of Moses' Long Island proposals. Doughty's friendship was to give Moses his first real hold on Jones Beach. After the meetings between the two men, the Republican boss told Moses to resubmit, with some minor revisions, the proposal so soundly defeated in the November 1925 referendum. Moses did so in November 1926, and the 3-to-1 margin against the proposal magically became a 3-to-1 margin in favor, Hempstead Town voting 18,872 to 5,076